Welcome to The Independent Entrepreneur, available online at www.indiebizshow.com. My name is Sean Salisbury, and today we're talking with Blake Scholl, co-founder and CEO of Kima Labs, the makers of the recently released iPhone app, Barcode Hero. I first discovered Barcode Hero when it was launched over the summer in the iTunes Store, and found their application fun, engaging, as well as incredibly useful. Blake is taking the reins for the first time as CEO in his new startup, and we will soon see why he is well suited for the role. We discuss leadership, marketing, and why, as businessmen and women, we shouldn't listen to our customers too much. And with that, we turn to Blake Scholl, who is joining us via Skype from San Francisco. Blake, we start with the first question we ask all our guests, which is, what was your first meaningful job and how would it influence your future career?
Oh, that's a great question. So I think there are two stories I can tell that sort of relate to each other. As a kid, I was very interested in computers and in programming, and I would sit at my dad's IBM and write stuff in BASIC. And I remember it dawned on me one day that, gosh, people get paid to do this, and so shouldn't I figure out a way to get paid as well? And I think the first money I ever made was writing shareware. I've written a little flashcard program and had distributed it on bulletin board systems. This was like early 90s before the web really existed. And then someone actually wanted the full upgraded shareware version, and I remember scrambling to get that done when someone actually wanted to buy it. So a few years later, the internet was starting to happen, and I got super excited about that. And my mom drove me around. This is when I was in high school. It drove me around from business to business, and I would walk in carrying my resume. And eventually got an offer from this company that was an internet service provider in Cincinnati, just a two-man shop. And went in there and was furiously writing code and helping them with projects. And it turned out poorly, actually. They never actually paid me. But it was, for me, a big lesson in people judgment. They'd done a lot to sort of build me up and tell me how great I was. And because of that, I was sort of lulled into doing things and actually pretty naive about the arrangement in retrospect. So it was a learning experience in character judgment.
So let's jump ahead then and jump right into Barcode Hero. Tell us, what was the genesis behind the idea? How did it come about? And tell us a little bit about the product.
I think it helps to understand a little bit of my context. I started my career at Amazon in 2001 and got to see Amazon go from a massive but completely unprofitable company to more like the powerhouse that it is today. And I sort of got to see the online shopping revolution from the inside and what happens really when you take something like mail order, that sort of traditional mail order model, and put it together with the web. So with that as the context, it put me in a position to notice things in terms of shopping offline. So earlier this year, when I knew I wanted to start something but I didn't know exactly what, I had a few personal experiences just going to stores and trying to decide, for example, what vacuum cleaner to buy, and was disappointed by the lack of information in a store, the lack of helpful salespeople, the lack of ability to even know whether you're getting a good deal. And so that made me think, gosh, all these things that exist online don't really exist in physical stores today, yet that's still where people spend most of their money. It was really sort of that personal experience of, gosh, I wish I had a better product to use here. I wish there was something that would help me in this situation that inspired me as an entrepreneur to go off and try to build something to solve that.
So how did the idea of Barcode Hero come about? Tell us more specifically about the product itself.
So the product is basically a application for your mobile phone, like for your iPhone, that helps you figure out what you want to buy when you're actually in a physical store. One thing you can do is, let's say you walk into a grocery store and you want to buy a bottle of wine. It's date night tonight, but you're not a wine connoisseur. You're not the person who knows the right vintage and the right winery and so forth. You're an average person. You're not not a wine snob. And wine's kind of a mystical category. It's hard to know what you really want. So what you can do with Barcode Hero is pick up any particular bottle of wine, scan it, and then find out what people you know actually said. So if one of your friends had tried that particular bottle, you might be able to see that they recommended, or maybe a wine reviewer that you trust has recommended a different wine, so you'd find that out. So it's a way of sort of going from, I don't know what product I really want, down to a, you know, a specific item you might want to buy.
And when you say scan the product, you're scanning the actual barcode on the product.
That's right. So it uses the camera on an iPhone to take a picture of the barcode, and then it, just in a second or two, it reads the barcode and can look up that particular product and look up alternative products.
So tell us, why did you decide to go into business for yourself?
I've known for a long time that I wanted to do a startup, that I wanted to run my own company. It's been an ambition basically since I was a kid. And it was a matter of what's the right time and what's the right business. And when you think about that, I feel like there are three circles you have to intersect. There's the place where there's an interesting opportunity, there's a problem to be solved. There's the stuff you can get excited about, and then there's the stuff that you're actually going to be good at. And you have to have all three of those things. You have to be excited, there has to be an opportunity, and you have to have the background you need to succeed at it. For example, I'd love to start an airline company, but I doubt I'd be very good at that.
So how did you know you were ready?
I think it pays not to worry too much about whether you're ready. When you find something that's an opportunity that you can get excited about and you can start to see how you would attack it, you don't sit around and say, well, gosh, I don't know if I'm ready to be CEO yet. You say, well, let me just go try to solve this problem and let me not worry about whether I'm going to succeed. Let me just take it as far as I can. So if you're at the point of asking the question, am I ready? The answer is you're probably ready. Think about the problem, not think about yourself.
That's great advice. What is the business model for Barcode Hero?
The application is completely free to consumers, and we plan to keep it that way basically always. But what we're trying to do is help consumers when they're actually in a physical store deciding what they want to buy. And that's a place where, if we can do that, it's a place where a lot of advertisers will want to participate. You can imagine things like you've got a shopper who is looking for shampoo and looking at the Suave shampoo. And gosh, if you're Pantene or Pert or some new shampoo manufacturer, you'd love a chance to show an ad to that shopper and be able to influence that purchase decision. So I think there are going to be a lot of things that we're going to be able to do about letting merchants or letting brands or manufacturers talk to shoppers while they're actually making their shopping decisions. I think there's a lot of money to be made if we can actually be in that place.
So you have an advertising opportunity as well as, I know that if you scan the product, it can show you where you can buy it online as well, which I assume you can get commissions or whatnot from that too.
Yeah, there are commissions there. We try to be agnostic about where a consumer actually makes a purchase. And 95% of the time, I think the purchase will actually be made in a physical store. Maybe 5% of the time, it's online. And we want to have a business model where we're aligned with the customer. Whatever's the best thing for the customer, we can profit from.
I see. Okay. So you expect, if you think most people are going to buy it in the store, you actually expect that advertising might actually be more lucrative than sales commissions.
Oh, absolutely. I think you could see similar kinds of rates that you see for affiliate programs online, where merchants are paying, you know, 5 to 10% of sales for a sale they wouldn't have otherwise gotten for the same kind of thing in store.
So you've raised a round of seed money to fund your business. Can you tell us about why you decided to take this route in launching your company?
You know, there are various ways you can go, right? You can choose to, if you have the money, you can fund the business yourself. You can try to bootstrap a business where you get to revenue quickly and you sort of let the business self-fund. Or you go down this path where you try to get external investors. For us, the first one was basically off the table. We didn't have the cash to fund the business ourselves. So it was a matter of, do we want to try to do something that gets to revenue quickly and gets to sort of self-sustaining quickly, or do we want to go get investors first? And we looked at both of those paths and felt like this is the kind of opportunity where you're not necessarily well-served by getting revenue quickly. You know, so for example, if we were motivated by short-term revenue, we would do things like quickly go get a deal with retailers, go get a deal with brands, and put ads into the product quickly, and at that point be very beholden to those third parties in terms of what the experience could actually be like. So felt like it'd probably be detrimental to the product to over-focus on revenue early. And on the other hand, given our background, given the market we're attacking, given the story we can tell, it seemed very feasible to go off and raise money. And that would allow us to go faster and to build a better product. So we chose to go that way. And investors also bring other things to the table. The money is the small piece, really. The bigger things are the credibility you get from having good people involved, the advice they can give you, the connections they can make. They can open doors you didn't even know existed if you've got the right people involved.
So how did you go about choosing your investors?
The approach we ultimately took was to basically go to people, either with people we knew or people we could get introductions to, and just tell them the kind of business we're creating, the kind of people we are, how we think about things. And there are different kinds of startups. There are different kinds of investors that look for different sorts of models or different levels of ambition. And ultimately, the thing was just to explain ourselves and what we're trying to do. And the right kind of people at that point get excited, and the wrong kind of people get turned off. And you go from there.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the benefits of having investors and maybe even what strings are attached to having them?
So the benefits of having investors, if you choose good ones, and it's very important to choose good ones, it's better to have no investors than an investor who's not well aligned with you or that you don't trust. But the benefits, aside from the money, are mainly credibility. It means that, you know, someone who's a professional, someone who has been successful, has looked at you and has passed some judgment, and that's going to help you when you need to go do business deals. That's going to help you when you need to go hire employees. There are connections, particularly for a tech startup, for example. A good investor will be able to introduce you to other people in the industry, be able to get you into conferences that you didn't know existed, be able to help you do deals by introducing you to the right people inside another organization, be able to help you with advice on your product. As far as strings, you have to look at what kind of stage you're at and what kind of terms you have with your investors, and that's going to vary a lot depending on your situation. For us, we raised money from literally 22 different investors, each of them putting in relatively small amounts of money. So there's no substantial amount of control that we've given away. And so for us, it's been relatively few strings attached, but basically having some really awesome, helpful people involved in the business. And when we need something, we can pick up the phone and, you know, those guys are happy to answer.
Was that a specific strategy that you employed, was to get a large number of small investors because of that, so you could maintain control?
I wouldn't paint it as quite that deliberate. There are a couple ways you can structure a seed round as a technology startup. And one of them is you find a lead, and that person you basically negotiate with, and you find other investors to follow that lead in terms of the lead set. So then the lead in that case might take a board seat or might do other things that involve more control. And on the other hand, also involve them helping you more. Or if you can do this quote-unquote mass syndicated round where it's sort of a large number of relatively smaller investors, you can do that as well. And I don't know if there's really one that's better than the other. We felt like we knew enough people and had enough relationships that we could do the sort of mass syndicate round and get it done. So we felt like that was the right thing to do and let us get back and actually focus on building our business.
Now, when you launched Barcode Hero, before that you had set up a company called Kima Labs, which I guess is the actual company that you have. Can you tell us about your launch strategy here, why you decided to wait until launching the product to actually come out with the name and that kind of thing?
So basically, Kima Labs is the company and Barcode Hero is the product. We had planned initially to call the product Kima, but it had various issues. People sometimes misheard it as chemo, just not the association you really want. And so we got a bunch of feedback that the name wasn't quite right for the product. So I don't think we actually had the product name until maybe 4 or 5 weeks before we actually launched the product. It was one of the last things that actually got settled.
Oh, wow. How did you come up with the name or finalize on it?
So we did a bunch of experimentation. There was a short list of 5 or 6 names that we were considering, and we talked to consumers about them. We would bring people in for focus groups and say, here are a bunch of names. Imagine that you see them in the Apple App Store. What would you actually download? And then what would you think it would actually be? And then we would show them our product, and then we would say, what name do you think actually matches the product? And it turned out that there was a different name, Royal Shoppers, that people would pick off the whiteboard, but then would describe an app that was very, very different from what we were actually planning to build. So Barcode Hero tested very well in terms of people understanding that this is the product that fits with this name. And then separately, we did some tests actually on Facebook, where we would run Facebook ads and say, hey, get product name for your iPhone, and it would just show a picture of the iPhone and not say anything about what the product actually was. And we measured click-through rates on those ads and sort of see what names people would by default respond most to, including among different demographics. And Barcode Hero blew away the rest of our names in terms of just people's positive reaction just to the name.
Wow. So why did you decide to keep it the whole thing a secret basically until you launched it? Can you talk about the strategy behind that?
Sure. So it's the classic startup stealth mode or not stealth mode thing. And when you are going into a relatively competitive space, there's a good reason to sort of try and keep things quiet. Other folks might copy your ideas. You might sort of lose anticipation. There's some effects you can generate from people not knowing what you're doing and wondering, and that can help build buzz. For us, I think it was mainly knowing that it was likely to be a competitive space, and we had an approach that was pretty different from what a lot of folks were looking at. We wanted to sort of keep that for ourselves until we were ready to show it to the world.
How did you know when you were ready to launch the product? Did you have a deadline? Did you want to bring it to a point where, was it a point where you just knew it was time to launch it? Can you talk about that?
Sure. So this is a subject of intense debate between entrepreneurs. And for me, I feel like you're ready to launch when you're proud of what you've built, you think it's a good product, and it's sufficiently polished that people can at least understand what it is. So as we were developing, we would bring in users who we didn't know every Friday and show them our app and just see how far they would get playing with it. And at the end of the session, ask them to tell us what they thought the product at least was. And we worked on it until people were able to get through the main use cases, that they basically actually worked in the product and people were able to get through them from a usability perspective. And that when we would ask them what the product is, they would repeat it back to us in, you know, words like the words we would use. So we felt like in a room with consumers asking them what they would use, it's very, very difficult to get a good answer. It's very hypothetical. It's very different from the situation and decisions people will actually make when they're really trying a real product. So that's very hard to predict. But what you can get a good read on is, for what you're trying to do, can people even understand it? And if you can clear that bar, then you launch and you know whatever reaction you get is really a reaction to your product and not a reaction to bugs or confusions. So if it works, you know that, you know, that's great, obviously, that, you know, people like what you've built. And if it doesn't work, you can bet that it was the product that was wrong and not the implementation.
So did you just go out on the streets of San Francisco and drag people into your office, or how did you do that?
We went on Craigslist and said, hey, we're a startup, we've got an iPhone app, and we'll pay you some bucks to come in and take a look at it.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you can find more than enough people pretty quickly that way.
Let's talk about the social aspect of the application. I know social media and whatnot is a big buzz now. How did you make the integration between social media and the shopping experience?
It was really the confluence of several things. We didn't set out to build a social product. We set out to build a product that would be helpful to people when they're actually shopping. And so if you sort of imagine yourself in a store and you need a new vacuum cleaner, for example, and there are five in front of you and you just want to pick amongst them, like what do you really want to know? What would help you make a decision fast in the moment? I think what big answer is, it's a simple content from someone you actually trust. So if, you know, a friend of yours who has pets says, hey, the Hoover is great on pet hair, it's super reliable, I recommend it. Those two or three sentences are really all you need to say, well, you know what, the price is right, I'm just going to go with the Hoover. So what we realized was simple recommendations from sources you trust are a big deal. A big deal especially because they're short, they're easy to read while you're actually in a store. So there's this, you shrink the size of content, more people are willing to do it, therefore it can actually be from people that you know. And so on one hand, that's useful. And on the other hand, people love talking about stuff. And people have passion around the stuff that they own, be it their musical instruments, or they're a pilot and they've got their flying gear and they love that, or they're into comic books and they have a true passion around there. And so it's been a big deal for us to basically let people share recommendations around the things that they actually really care about.
Let's jump into marketing here. You know, you build a great product, you put it out there, and then every small business owner struggles with this, especially when they're starting. How do they get the word out? How do they get customers in the door? Tell us about your marketing strategy and what's working for you.
For a consumer internet product, you need to build your marketing plan basically into the product. You need to think about distribution from day one. If you don't, it can be very challenging because you end up buying advertising or doing other sorts of promotions that are very expensive and not necessarily super effective. So we were building a social product, a product that's about sharing with people that you know. And therefore, it sort of makes sense fundamentally that we should be able to get some viral distribution. So from that sense, the distribution model, the person-to-person distribution, was baked into the very concept of the product. And it's from that point forward, it's really a matter of working out the details and making measurements of what's working and what's not, and continuing to tune it. And then you can layer other marketing things on top of it. We're working on some PR stuff for the holiday season. We were very lucky to get featured by Apple in the App Store after we launched. That helps a lot. The fundamental is, if you can build a product that distributes itself virally, that's an awesome thing.
Tell us how many people are on your team.
So it's still a super early team. Both my co-founder and I are engineers by training, and we realized we could actually build and ship this just the two of us. So that's what we did.
Wow.
And now that we're out there and we're starting to get some great feedback from users, we're starting to actually build a team. We made our first offer recently, and if we're lucky, we'll have employee number one next Monday.
What are the biggest challenges you're currently facing as a company?
As a company, we have a pretty ambitious vision about what we want to accomplish. We ultimately see ourselves being deeply coupled to how people shop in a store, everything from how they find out what's on sale when they walk in the door, to how they choose amongst products, to even how they buy. And it's something that's a pretty massive space. And there's always the question of, as a startup, well, where do you start, and how do you attack it, and how do you bite off meaningful chunks such that you've always got something that's working, but it's taking you in the direction that you want to go. And that's something we spend a lot of time thinking about, is basically what's the path from where we are today to world domination, if you will, and how do we take small steps that we can actually execute on and that we can refine the product along the way. So to be a little bit more specific, today we've built a product that's very, it's got a gaming aspect to it. It makes it really fun to share recommendations, and that's a lot of what people do. It's just use it to share and kind of play the game and have fun putting recommendations in. And there's a sort of a tricky path for us to navigate of how we take that kind of usage and then shape it into something that's actually going to be really useful to people when they're actually in the store. And how is it going to be so useful that people remember to take their phone out of their pocket and actually use it? So the stuff we're focusing on now for the holiday season is that next big shift of the product that takes it from being something that's fun to use by yourself at home to something that you actually really want to use when you're out shopping.
What metrics do you guys look at to measure success in your company and with the product?
So metrics we look at right now, it's basically how much traffic are we getting and how well are we doing at turning that traffic into passionate users. So there's an acquisition metric, which is basically new users. There is an activation metric, which is how many of those new users are actually getting deep into the product, that are actually sharing something. And then there's a retention metric, which is are people coming back? As things develop, we'll also be looking at revenue metrics, but that's later. Viral metrics, but that's a little bit later as far as our tuning as well.
Yeah, because I found that, when I first got the product, I've used it. It's a lot of fun. I went and I scanned every book that I had, every piece of sheet music. I became the king of sheet music in using that. But I found that over time, it becomes more casual. I think that's okay, and I've used it a number of times in the store. In fact, while I was buying a vacuum cleaner, for example, believe it or not. Are you finding this to be the case with most of your users?
What we've seen today is that people, when they first get new applications, they're not usually in a store. That's not where you are. You're typically at home. And people run around their home and they scan products and they scan things they like, and that encourages them to scan more things they like, and they start becoming king of things they care about. And if they get sufficiently engaged, then you start to see a little bit of usage in the store. So so the experience you described is fairly typical. And if you look at the user interface we actually built today, it's not terribly surprising. I think there's some different things we need to do in the product to really make it awesome in store.
Can you talk about some of those things?
There is a revision that we're working on that will come out in time for the holiday shopping season that will have things in it that will be super useful when you're doing that holiday shopping, helping you when you have to get a gift for your niece and you don't know which gift you really want. Or there's that thing for mom and, gosh, mom is hard to buy for and you're looking for some ideas. So we'll help you when you're drawing a blank. We'll help you when you're not sure exactly what kind of thing to get given someone's interest. And we'll help you see just what's hot, what other people are shopping for. So I think it's the kind of thing that hopefully will be useful year-round, but I think will be especially useful to people in their holiday shopping.
Will Kima Labs create other products? Is there like a genre of products that you think you'll focus on, or is Barcode Hero, you know, your full focus and main long-term strategy?
Well, our full focus and main long-term strategy is in-store retail, and that's pretty broad. It's a $14 trillion market. There aren't that many markets bigger.
Uh-huh.
Is Barcode Hero the only product or not? I don't really know yet. It could be that we end up with a sort of a family of products that are useful in different ways. Maybe there's a gift application and a Barcode Hero application and a wedding registry application, and they all sort of share the same style of, hey, we're helping you in a store. Or it might be that we could take all those things and put them into one app. We're not committed one way or the other, really. It's a matter of we'll look at what's the best way to actually help people and go that way. But I don't see us anytime soon going into a totally different category. We're not going to build, you know, airplane software.
So you've taken the CEO position in your company. What does that mean to be the CEO, and how are you uniquely qualified to fit that role, and what attracts you to the position?
I can tell you the story of how we ended up setting the roles. My co-founder and I are both folks who've wanted to be entrepreneurs for a long time, and I think we both thought that meant be CEO. And so before we started the company, there was this sort of tense conversation of, okay, what are the roles and titles actually? And we talked about co-CEO and we talked about co-president and thought, well, gosh, those are probably a little goofy. Those are like not really answering the question. So what we ultimately did that worked is sat down and just made a list of what were the things that needed to be accomplished in the company and which were the ones that each of us was most interested in working on. And what we found was that some of them were naturally the sort of external facing things like coordinating PR and marketing, raising money, managing the relationship with investors, marketing, that kind of thing. And some were the like product design, product planning, managing the engineering team, deciding the technology approach, making sure that's all on track. And I was most interested in the stuff that was external facing, and my co-founder was most interested in the stuff that was internal facing. And that solved the problem for us, because the external facing stuff is, you know, most classically the CEO role, and the internal facing stuff makes sense as co-founder and CTO. So we said, okay, well, let's just go on that, and we can always revisit down path as things evolve.
That's interesting. Instead of, you know, arguing over who gets what title, if you make a list of the actual things that you'll actually be doing, that can really help define that.
Yeah, I found that to be a pattern that works over and over again. With one of the candidates that we have an offer out to now, there was a discussion about titles. And I found that title discussion really is not the conversation to have. What you want to have a conversation about is roles. What is the actual job? What are you actually doing? And what's your career path? And title is just how you communicate that to other people. What I found works is start with what you're actually doing, and then at the end of that process, choose the title that matches.
Can you tell us a little bit about leadership? What does leadership mean to you?
We're a two-person company now. We're both co-founders. So leadership here is very different from, I think, what it will be like later. But long-term, the CEO's most important role is knowing the vision of the company, communicating the vision, making that clear to people, and making sure it's not abandoned. And that means reiterating it over and over again. That means making sure the company makes decisions that are consistent with that. That means knowing when to say no to things that are off path. And it means being inspirational. It means, you know, painting a picture for people about the world that you're going to that's not yet real, and letting them see that, inspiring them to work pretty hard, because startups are hard work, to make it real.
You're about to hopefully get your first employee. Can you talk about how you motivate employees and how you find good people to work for you?
Finding good people is tough. There are always more jobs than there are fantastic, top-notch people to fill them. And recruiting is probably the most difficult thing for an early-stage startup, and the most important from the aspect of, you have no assets really except the people who are helping you build the business. It's much easier to to change just about anything that it is to change the team and the culture that you've built. As far as motivation, particularly at a startup, I think motivation is about what are you actually creating? It's about the product. It's about what you're accomplishing in the world. And the kind of people who will join a startup are motivated by vision. They're motivated by the chance to build something that could be important. They're motivated by the chance to do fantastic work that they're proud of. And so I think a lot of motivation is just painting that picture and then removing roadblocks. Engineers, for example, classically hate the work environments that are always pushing them to cut corners, and they feel like, yeah, I kind of did a half-assed job on that, and I don't feel great about it. But building the sort of work environment where people feel like they can do their best work and they feel like they're more productive than they would have been on their own, or more productive than they would have been somewhere else, and that's tremendously motivating.
What's one of the biggest lessons you've learned as a businessman and an entrepreneur?
I think that the biggest thing I learned at the last company I was at is, and this is very difficult for ambitious companies. So if you come to a market and you have, as a founder, a big idea of what you want to go accomplish, and it's got many components to it, and you can see the whole thing in your mind, all the pieces interlocking, and you even have a lot of ideas about what it might look like specifically. Well, that's more than you can accomplish in one step. And you're probably, you might be right about the vision, but you're probably wrong about the details. And there's a big challenge of basically how do you stay true to your vision while continuing to listen to your customers? And how do you attack a piece of your vision that you can start with today and really deliver as a two-person team, as a five-person team, as a tiny company, yet still takes you in the direction of your long-term vision? It's really easy to drop one or the other, where you just go based on your mental idea of where you're going and your big ideas, and you forget to listen to customers and you forget to listen to the market. Or, on the other hand, you lose sight of your vision, you get distracted by all the people who are telling you what to do, you listen to your customers too much, and then you sort of wander rather than go in a direction.
Can you talk more about that, about listening to your customers too much? That's really an interesting point.
The fundamental thing is you want to understand your customers' lives and their values, and then innovate on their behalf. It's not your customer's job to tell you what your product should be or how it should work. That's your expertise. That's your business. What you want to do, and this is tricky to actually accomplish, is understand your customers' lives, understand their actual values, understand what's actually good for them in a, in an abstract sense, and then invent a product that will be useful to them. For us, it means things like understanding how people actually shop. What kinds of challenges do they really hit? Where do they get stuck? What are the most important shopping values? When does price matter? When does getting the right item matter? But not to say, hey, well, what shopping application do you want for your iPhone? That's not their job to answer. That's our job. And if we understand their lives sufficiently well, we understand their values sufficiently well, then we can come up with a good answer. And then we can go back to them and test and say, hey, we came up with this. What do you think? Or better yet, we came up with this. Why don't you go use it? And we'll see if it's useful to you. It's about understanding and not necessarily asking your customers to design your product for you, which is basically, unless you have a particularly visionary set of customers, it's just not likely to go well.
What advice can you offer to anyone who's thinking about starting their own business?
Well, I think starting your own business can be pretty intimidating. It makes you look at yourself and say, can I really do this? Am I up to the task? And I think one of the things I would suggest is don't worry about that. When you're figuring out what you want to attack and whether you want to jump in, pretend that you could solve any problem, that no challenge is beyond you, and think about what you see in the world and what you want to accomplish, and worry more about what it is you're going to go do and how you're going to go do it and how excited you are about that than about how much you can really bite off. And so I would encourage entrepreneurs to be more ambitious, to look at the really big problems and go off and solve them. And you might succeed, and that's great, or you might not, and you'll learn a lot along the way and grow as a person.
Do you have an exit strategy for Barcode Hero?
I have an exit philosophy, which is make long-term decisions, build a business that you'd like to run for years. And then if you find yourself with a compelling acquisition opportunity, then you take it, and if not, you don't. But if you focus overly on exits too early, I think it's easy to make decisions that are too short-term.
Tell us about how people can find you and Barcode Hero.
So we are on the web at barcodehero.com. We're in the App Store. Just search for Barcode Space Hero. And you can email me at blake@barcodehero.com.
Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy day, Blake, to talk to us. And we wish you a profitable future.
Thanks, Sean. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Independent Entrepreneur. The show's theme song, Tommy in the Morning, is by Pete Huttlinger and used with his permission. Visit his website at www.petehuttlinger.com. All other content on this show is copyright 2010 by Sean Salisbury. We hope you've enjoyed this interview. For more information and to listen to other interviews, please visit www.indiebizshow.com. That's www.indiebizshow.com.